Evangelium Vitae to the bishops, priests and deacons, men and women religiously faithful, and all people of goodwill, on the value and inviolability of human life. Introduction. 1. The gospel of life is at the heart of Jesus' message. Lovingly received day after day by the Church, it is to be preached with dauntless fidelity, as good news, to the people of every age and culture. At the dawn of salvation, it is the birth of a child which is proclaimed as joyful news, "I bring you good news of a great joy which will come to all the people, for to you is born this day, in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." Luke 2:10-11. The source of this great joy is the birth of the Savior, but Christmas also reveals the full meaning of every human birth, and the joy which accompanies the birth of the Messiah is thus seen to be the foundation and fulfillment of joy at every child born into the world. Cf. John 16:21. When he presents the heart of his redemptive mission, Jesus says, "I came that they may have life, and have it abundantly." John 10:10. In truth, he is referring to that new and eternal life which consists in communion with the Father, to which every person is freely called in the Son, by the power of the sanctifying Spirit. It is precisely in this life that all the aspects and stages of human life achieve their full significance, the incomparable worth of the human person. 2. Man is called to a fullness of life which far exceeds the dimensions of his earthly existence, because it consists in sharing the very life of God. The loftiness of this supernatural vocation reveals the greatness and the inestimable value of human life even in its temporal phase. Life and time, in fact, is the fundamental condition, the initial stage, and an integral part of the entire unified process of human existence. It is a process which, unexpectedly and undeservedly, is enlightened by the promise and renewed by the gift of divine life, which will reach its full realization in eternity. Cf. 1 John 3:1-2. At the same time, it is precisely this supernatural calling which highlights the relative character of each individual's earthly life. After all, life on earth is not an ultimate, but a penultimate reality. Even so, it remains a sacred reality entrusted to us, to be preserved with a sense of responsibility, and brought to perfection in love, and in the gift of ourselves to God, and to our brothers and sisters. The Church knows that this gospel of life, which she has received from her Lord, one has a profound and persuasive echo in the heart of every person, believer and non-believer alike, because it marvelously fulfills all the heart's expectations, while infinitely surpassing them. Even in the midst of difficulties and uncertainties, every person sincerely open to truth and goodness can, by the light of reason and the hidden action of grace, come to recognize in the natural law written in the heart, cf. Rom 2:14-15, the sacred value of human life from its very beginning until its end, and can affirm the right of every human being to have this primary good respected to the highest degree. Upon the recognition of this right, every human community and the political community itself are founded. In a special way, believers in Christ must defend and promote this right, aware, as they are, of the wonderful truth recalled by the Second Vatican Council: by His incarnation the Son of God has united Himself in some fashion with every human being. Point to this saving event reveals to humanity not only the boundless love of God, who so loved the world that He gave His only Son, John 3:16, but also the incomparable value of every human person. The Church, faithfully contemplating the mystery of the redemption, acknowledges this value with ever new wonder. Point 3. She feels called to proclaim to the people of all times this gospel, the source of invincible hope and true joy for every period of history. The gospel of God's love for man, the gospel of the dignity of the person, and the gospel of life are a single and indivisible gospel. For this reason, man, living man, represents the primary and fundamental way for the Church. 4. New threats to human life. 3. Every individual, precisely by reason of the mystery of the Word of God, who was made flesh, cf. John 1:14, is entrusted to the maternal care of the Church, Therefore, every threat to human dignity and life must necessarily be felt in the Church's very heart. It cannot but affect her at the core of her faith in the redemptive incarnation of the Son of God, and engage her in her mission of proclaiming the gospel of life in all the world and to every creature. Cf. Mark 16:15. Today this proclamation is especially pressing because of the extraordinary increase and gravity of threats to the life of individuals and peoples, especially where life is weak and defenseless. In addition to the ancient scourges of poverty, hunger, endemic diseases, violence, and war, new threats are emerging on an alarmingly vast scale. The Second Vatican Council, in a passage which retains all its relevance today, forcefully condemned a number of crimes and attacks against human life. 30 years later, taking up the words of the Council, and with the same forcefulness I repeat that condemnation in the name of the whole Church, certain that I am interpreting the genuine sentiment of every upright conscience. Whatever is opposed to life itself, such as any type of murder, genocide, abortion, euthanasia, or willful self-destruction, whatever violates the integrity of the human person, such as mutilation, torments inflicted on body or mind, attempts to coerce the will itself, whatever insults human dignity, such as subhuman living conditions, arbitrary imprisonment, deportation, slavery, prostitution, the selling of women and children, as well as disgraceful working conditions where people are treated as mere instruments of gain rather than as free and responsible persons, all these things and others like them are infamies indeed. They poison human society, and they do more harm to those who practice them than to those who suffer from the injury. Moreover, they are a supreme dishonor to the Creator. 5.4. Unfortunately, this disturbing state of affairs, far from decreasing, is expanding, with the new prospects opened up by scientific and technological progress. There arise new forms of attacks on the dignity of the human being. At the same time, a new cultural climate is developing and taking hold, which gives crimes against life a new and, if possible, even more sinister character, giving rise to further grave concern. Broad sectors of public opinion justify certain crimes against life in the name of the rights of individual freedom, and on this basis they claim not only exemption from punishment, but even authorization by the state, so that these things can be done with total freedom, and indeed with the free assistance of healthcare systems. All this is causing a profound change in the way in which life and relationships between people are considered. The fact that legislation in many countries, perhaps even departing from basic principles of their constitutions, has determined not to punish these practices against life, and even to make them altogether legal, is both a disturbing symptom and a significant cause of grave moral decline. Choices once unanimously considered criminal and rejected by the common moral sense are gradually becoming socially acceptable. Even certain sectors of the medical profession, which by its calling is directed to the defense and care of human life, are increasingly willing to carry out these acts against the person. In this way, the very nature of the medical profession is distorted and contradicted, and the dignity of those who practice it is degraded. In such a cultural and legislative situation, the serious demographic, social and family problems which weigh upon many of the world's peoples, and which require responsible and effective attention from national and international bodies, are left open to false and deceptive solutions, opposed to the truth and the good of persons and nations. The end result of this is tragic. Not only is the fact of the destruction of so many human lives still to be born, or in their final stage, extremely grave and disturbing, but no less grave and disturbing is the fact that conscience itself, darkened, as it were, by such widespread conditioning, is finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between good and evil in what concerns the basic value of human life. In communion with all the bishops of the world. 5. The extraordinary consistory of cardinals held in Rome on 4th to the 7th of April, 1991 was devoted to the problem of the threats to human life in our day, After a thorough and detailed discussion of the problem and of the challenges it poses to the entire human family, and in particular to the Christian community, the cardinals unanimously asked me to reaffirm with the authority of the successor of Peter the value of human life and its inviolability in the light of present circumstances and attacks threatening it today. In response to this request, at Pentecost, in 1991 I wrote a personal letter to each of my brother bishops asking them, in the spirit of episcopal collegiality, to offer me their cooperation in drawing up a specific document. 6. I am deeply grateful to all the bishops who replied and provided me with valuable facts, suggestions, and proposals. In so doing, they bore witness to their unanimous desire to share in the doctrinal and pastoral mission of the Church with regard to the gospel of life. In that same letter, written shortly after the celebration of the centenary of the encyclical Rerum Novarum, I drew everyone's attention to this striking analogy. Just as a century ago it was the working classes which were oppressed in their fundamental rights, and the Church very courageously came to their defense by proclaiming the sacrosanct rights of the worker as a person, so now, when another category of persons is being oppressed in the fundamental right to life, the Church feels in duty bound to speak out with the same courage on behalf of those who have no voice. Hers is always the evangelical cry in defense of the world's poor, those who are threatened and despised, and whose human rights are violated. 7. Today there exists a great multitude of weak and defenseless human beings, unborn children in particular, whose fundamental right to life is being trampled upon. If, at the end of the last century, the Church could not be silent about the injustices of those times, still less can she be silent today, when the social injustices of the past, unfortunately not yet overcome, are being compounded in many regions of the world by still more grievous forms of injustice and oppression, even if these are being presented as elements of progress in view of a new world order. The present encyclical, the fruit of the cooperation of the episcopate of every country of the world, is therefore meant to be a precise and vigorous reaffirmation of the value of human life and its inviolability, and at the same time a pressing appeal addressed to each and every person, in the name of God, respect, protect, love, and serve life, every human life. Only in this direction will you find justice, development, true freedom, peace, and happiness. May these words reach all the sons and daughters of the Church. May they reach all people of goodwill, who are concerned for the good of every man and woman, and for the destiny of the whole of society. 6. In profound communion with all my brothers and sisters in the faith, and inspired by genuine friendship towards all, I wish to meditate upon once more, and proclaim the gospel of life, the splendour of truth which enlightens consciences, the clear light which corrects the darkened gaze, and the unfailing source of faithfulness and steadfastness in facing the ever-new challenges which we meet along our path. As I recall the powerful experience of the year, of the family, as if to complete the letter which I wrote to every particular family in every part of the world, 8. I look with renewed confidence to every household, and I pray that at every level a general commitment to support the family will reappear and be strengthened, so that today too, even amid so many difficulties and serious threats, the family will always remain, in accordance with God's plan, the sanctuary of life. 9. To all the members of the Church, the people of life, and for life, I make this most urgent appeal, that together we may offer this world of ours new signs of hope, and work to ensure that justice and solidarity will increase, and that a new culture of human life will be affirmed, for the building of an authentic civilization of truth and love. Chapter I.THE Voice OFYOUR Brothers Blood Christ EOMEFROMTHE Ground. Present day threats to human life. Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. Genesis 4:8. The roots of violence against life. 7. God did not make death, and he does not delight in the death of the living, for he has created all things that they might exist. God created man for incorruption, and made him in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy death entered the world, and those who belong to his party experience it. Wis 1:13-14, 2:23-24. The gospel of life, proclaimed in the beginning, when man was created in the image of God, for a destiny of full and perfect life, cf. Genesis 2:7, Wis 9:2-3, is contradicted by the painful experience of death which enters the world and casts its shadow of meaninglessness over man's entire existence. Death came into the world as a result of the devil's envy, cf. Genesis 3:1, 4-5, and the sin of our first parents, cf. Genesis 2:17, 3:17-19, and death entered it in a violent way, through the killing of Abel, by his brother Cain. And, when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and killed him, Genesis 4:8. This first murder is presented with singular eloquence in a page of the book of Genesis which has universal significance. It is a page rewritten daily, with inexorable and degrading frequency, in the book of human history. Let us reread together this biblical account which, despite its archaic structure and its extreme simplicity, has much to teach us. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a tiller of the ground. In the course of time Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel, and his offering, but for Cain, and his offering he had not regard. So Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." Cain said to Abel his brother, "Let us go out to the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel, and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And the Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me this day away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden, and I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will slay me." Then the Lord said to him, "Not so. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who came upon him should kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord, and dwelt in the land of Nod, east of Eden, Genesis 4:2-16. 8. Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell, because the Lord had regard for Abel, and his offering, Genesis 4:4-5. The biblical text does not reveal the reason why God prefers Abel's sacrifice to Cain's. It clearly shows, however, that God, although preferring Abel's gift, does not interrupt his dialogue with Cain. He admonishes him, reminding him of his freedom in the face of evil. Man is in no way predestined to evil. Certainly, like Adam, he is tempted by the malevolent force of sin which, like a wild beast, lies in wait at the door of his heart, ready to leap on its prey. But Cain remains free in the face of sin. He can, and must overcome it. "Its desire is for you, but you must master it," Genesis 4:7. Envy and anger have the upper hand over the Lord's warning, and so Cain attacks his own brother, and kills him, as we read in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, in the account of Abel's murder by his brother Cain. Scripture reveals the presence of anger and envy in man, consequences of original sin, from the beginning of human history. Man has become the enemy of his fellow man. 10. Brother kills brother. Like the first fratricide, every murder is a violation of the spiritual kinship uniting mankind in one great family, 11, in which all share the same fundamental good, equal personal dignity, not infrequently the kinship of flesh and blood, is also violated, for example, when threats to life arise within the relationship between parents and children, such as happens in abortion, or when, in the wider context of family or kinship, euthanasia is encouraged or practiced. At the root of every act of violence against one's neighbor there is a concession to the thinking of the evil one, the one who was a murderer from the beginning, John 8:44. As the Apostle John reminds us, "For this is the message which you have heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, and not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother." 1 John 3:11-12. Cain's killing of his brother at the very dawn of history is thus a sad witness of how evil spreads with amazing speed, man's revolt against God, in the earthly paradises followed by the deadly combat of man against man. After the crime, God intervenes to avenge the one killed. Before God, who asks him about the fate of Abel, Cain, instead of showing remorse and apologizing, arrogantly eludes the question, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Genesis 4:9. "I do not know." Cain tries to cover up his crime with a lie. This was, and still is the case, when all kinds of ideologies try to justify and disguise the most atrocious crimes against human beings. "Am I my brother's keeper?" Cain does not wish to think about his brother, and refuses to accept the responsibility which every person has towards others. We cannot but think of today's tendency for people to refuse to accept responsibility for their brothers and sisters. Symptoms of this trend include the lack of solidarity towards society's weakest members, such as the elderly, the infirm, immigrants, children, and the indifference frequently found in relations between the world's peoples, even when basic values such as survival, freedom, and peace are involved. 9. But God cannot leave the crime unpunished. From the ground on which it has been spilt, the blood of the one murdered demands that God should render justice. Cf. Genesis 37:26, 26:21, 24:7-8. From this text the church has taken the name of the sins which cry to God for justice, and, first among them, she has included willful murder. 12. For the Jewish people, as for many peoples of antiquity, blood is the source of life. Indeed, the blood is the life, Deuteronomy 12:23, and life, especially human life, belongs only to God. For this reason, whoever attacks human life, in some way attacks God himself. Cain is cursed by God and also by the earth, which will deny him its fruit. Cf. Genesis 4:11-12. He is punished. He will live in the wilderness and the desert. Murderous violence profoundly changes man's environment. From being the Garden of Eden, Genesis 2:15, a place of plenty, of harmonious interpersonal relationships, and of friendship with God, the earth becomes the land of naught, Genesis 4:16, a place of scarcity, loneliness, and separation from God. Cain will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, Genesis 4:14. Uncertainty and restlessness will follow him forever. And yet God, who is always merciful even when he punishes, put a mark on Cain, lest any who came upon him should kill him, Genesis 4:15. He thus gave him a distinctive sign, not to condemn him to the hatred of others, but to protect and defend him from those wishing to kill him, even out of a desire to avenge Abel's death. Not even a murderer loses his personal dignity, and God himself pledges to guarantee this. And it is precisely here that the paradoxical mystery of the merciful justice of God is shown forth. As St. Ambrose writes, "Once the crime is admitted at the very inception of this sinful act of parricide, then the divine law of God's mercy should be immediately extended. If punishment is forthwith inflicted on the accused, then men in the exercise of justice would in no way observe patience and moderation, but would straightway condemn the defendant to punishment. God drove Cain out of his presence, and sent him into exile far away from his native land, so that he passed from a life of human kindness to one which was more akin to the rude existence of a wild beast. God, who preferred the correction rather than the death of a sinner, did not desire that a homicide be punished by the exaction of another act of homicide." 13. What have you done? Genesis 4:10, the eclipse of the value of life. 10. The Lord said to Cain, What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. Genesis 4:10. The voice of the blood shed by men continues to cry out, from generation to generation, in ever new and different ways. The Lord's question, What have you done, which Cain cannot escape, is addressed also to the people of today, to make them realize the extent and gravity of the attacks against life which continue to mark human history, to make them discover what causes these attacks and feeds them, and to make them ponder seriously the consequences which derive from these attacks for the existence of individuals and peoples. Some threats come from nature itself, but they are made worse by the culpable indifference and negligence of those who could in some cases remedy them. Others are the result of situations of violence, hatred, and conflicting interests, which lead people to attack others through murder, war, slaughter, and genocide. And how can we fail to consider the violence against life done to millions of human beings, especially children, who are forced into poverty, malnutrition, and hunger because of an unjust distribution of resources between peoples and between social classes? And what of the violence inherent not only in wars as such, but in the scandalous arms trade, which spuns the many armed conflicts which stain our world with blood? What of the spreading of death caused by reckless tampering with the world's ecological balance, by the criminal spread of drugs, or by the promotion of certain kinds of sexual activity which, besides being morally unacceptable, also involve grave risks to life? It is impossible to catalog completely the vast array of threats to human life, so many are the forms, whether explicit or hidden, in which they appear today. 11. Here though we shall concentrate particular attention on another category of attacks, affecting life in its earliest and in its final stages, attacks which present new characteristics with respect to the past and which raise questions of extraordinary seriousness. It is not only that in generalized opinion these attacks tend no longer to be considered as crimes, paradoxically they assume the nature of rights, to the point that the state is called upon to give them legal recognition, and to make them available through the free services of healthcare personnel. Such attacks strike human life at the time of its greatest frailty, when it lacks any means of self-defense. Even more serious is the fact that, most often, those attacks are carried out in the very heart of and with the complicity of the family which by its nature is called to be the sanctuary of life. How did such a situation come about? Many different factors have to be taken into account. In the background there is the profound crisis of culture, which generates skepticism in relation to the very foundations of knowledge and ethics, and which makes it increasingly difficult to grasp clearly the meaning of what man is, the meaning of his rights, and his duties. Then there are all kinds of existential and interpersonal difficulties, made worse by the complexity of a society in which individuals, couples, and families are often left alone with their problems. There are situations of acute poverty, anxiety, or frustration, in which the struggle to make ends meet, the presence of unbearable pain, or instances of violence, especially against women, make the choice to defend and promote life so demanding as sometimes to reach the point of heroism. All this explains, at least in part, how the value of life can today undergo a kind of eclipse, even though conscience does not cease to point to it as a sacred and inviolable value, as is evident in the tendency to disguise certain crimes against life in its early or final stages by using innocuous medical terms which distract attention from the fact that what is involved is the right to life of an actual human person. 12. In fact, while the climate of widespread moral uncertainty can in some way be explained by the multiplicity and gravity of today's social problems, and these can sometimes mitigate the subjective responsibility of individuals, it is no less true that we are confronted by an even larger reality, which can be described as a veritable structure of sin. This reality is characterized by the emergence of a culture which denies solidarity, and in many cases takes the form of a veritable culture of death. This culture is actively fostered by powerful cultural, economic and political currents which encourage an idea of society excessively concerned with efficiency. Looking at the situation from this point of view, it is possible to speak in a certain sense of a war of the powerful against the weak, a life which would require greater acceptance, love, and care is considered useless, or held to be an intolerable burden, and is therefore rejected in one way or another. A person who, because of illness, handicap, or, more simply, just by existing, compromises the well-being or lifestyle of those who are more favored tends to be looked upon as an enemy to be resisted or eliminated. In this way, a kind of conspiracy against life is unleashed. This conspiracy involves not only individuals in their personal, family, or group relationships, but goes far beyond, to the point of damaging and distorting, at the international level, relations between peoples and states. 13. In order to facilitate the spread of abortion, enormous sums of money have been invested, and continue to be invested in the production of pharmaceutical products which make it possible to kill the fetus in the mother's womb without recourse to medical assistance. On this point, scientific research itself seems to be almost exclusively preoccupied with developing products which are ever more simple and effective in suppressing life, and which at the same time are capable of removing abortion from any kind of control or social responsibility. It is frequently asserted that contraception, if made safe and available to all, is the most effective remedy against abortion. The Catholic Church is then accused of actually promoting abortion, because she obstinately continues to teach the moral unlawfulness of contraception. When looked at carefully, this objection is clearly unfounded. It may be that many people use contraception with a view to excluding the subsequent temptation of abortion, but the negative values inherent in the contraceptive mentality, which is very different from responsible parenthood, lived in respect for the full truth of the conjugal act, are such that they in fact strengthen this temptation when an unwanted life is conceived. Indeed, the pro-abortion culture is especially strong precisely where the Church's teaching on contraception is rejected. Certainly, from the moral point of view, contraception and abortion are specifically different evils. The former contradicts the full truth of the sexual act as the proper expression of conjugal love, while the latter destroys the life of a human being. The former is opposed to the virtue of chastity in marriage, the latter is opposed to the virtue of justice, and directly violates the divine commandment, "You shall not kill." But despite their differences of nature and moral gravity, contraception and abortion are often closely connected, as fruits of the same tree. It is true that in many cases contraception and even abortion are practiced under the pressure of real life difficulties, which nonetheless can never exonerate from striving to observe God's law fully. Still, in very many other instances, such practices are rooted in a hedonistic mentality unwilling to accept responsibility in matters of sexuality, and they imply a self-centered concept of freedom, which regards procreation as an obstacle to personal fulfillment. The life which could result from a sexual encounter thus becomes an enemy to be avoided at all costs, and abortion becomes the only possible decisive response to failed contraception. The close connection which exists, in mentality, between the practice of contraception and that of abortion is becoming increasingly obvious. It is being demonstrated in an alarming way by the development of chemical products, intrauterine devices, and vaccines which, distributed with the same ease as contraceptives, really act as abortifacients in the very early stages of the development of the life of the new human being. 14. The various techniques of artificial reproduction, which would seem to be at the service of life, and which are frequently used with this intention, actually open the door to new threats against life. Apart from the fact that they are morally unacceptable, since they separate procreation from the fully human context of the conjugal act, 14. These techniques have a high rate of failure, not just failure in relation to fertilization, but with regard to the subsequent development of the embryo, which is exposed to the risk of death, generally within a very short space of time. Furthermore, the number of embryos produced is often greater than that needed for implantation in the woman's womb, and these so-called spare embryos are then destroyed or used for research which, under the pretext of scientific or medical progress, in fact reduces human life to the level of simple, biological material to be freely disposed of. Prenatal diagnosis, which presents no moral objections if carried out in order to identify the medical treatment which may be needed by the child in the womb, all too often becomes an opportunity for proposing and procuring an abortion. This is eugenic abortion, justified in public opinion on the basis of a mentality mistakenly held to be consistent with the demands of therapeutic interventions, which accepts life only under certain conditions and rejects it when it is affected by any limitation, handicap, or illness. Following the same logic, the point has been reached where the most basic care, even nourishment, is denied to babies born with serious handicaps or illnesses. The contemporary scene, moreover, is becoming even more alarming by reason of the proposals advanced here and there to justify even infanticide, following the same arguments used to justify the right to abortion. In this way, we revert to a state of barbarism which one hoped had been left behind forever. 15. Threats which are no less serious hang over the incurably ill and the dying, in a social and cultural context which makes it more difficult to face and accept suffering. The temptation becomes all the greater to resolve the problem of suffering by eliminating it at the root, by hastening death so that it occurs at the moment considered most suitable. Various considerations usually contribute to such a decision, all of which converge in the same terrible outcome. In the sick person, the sense of anguish, of severe discomfort, and even of desperation brought on by intense and prolonged suffering can be a decisive factor. Such a situation can threaten the already fragile equilibrium of an individual's personal and family life, with the result that, on the one hand, the sick person, despite the help of increasingly effective medical and social assistance, risks feeling overwhelmed by his or her own frailty, and on the other hand, those close to the sick person can be moved by an understandable even if misplaced compassion. All this is aggravated by a cultural climate which fails to perceive any meaning or value in suffering, but rather considers suffering the epitome of evil, to be eliminated at all costs. This is especially the case in the absence of a religious outlook which could help to provide a positive understanding of the mystery of suffering. On a more general level, there exists in contemporary culture a certain Promethean attitude which leads people to think that they can control life and death by taking the decisions about them into their own hands. What really happens in this case is that the individual is overcome and crushed by a death deprived of any prospect of meaning or hope. We see a tragic expression of all this in the spread of euthanasia disguised and surreptitious, or practiced openly and even legally, as well as for reasons of a misguided pity at the sight of the patient's suffering. Euthanasia is sometimes justified by the utilitarian motive of avoiding costs which bring no return and which weigh heavily on society. Thus it is proposed to eliminate malformed babies, the severely handicapped, the disabled, the elderly, especially when they are not self-sufficient, and the terminally ill. Nor can we remain silent in the face of other more furtive, but no less serious and real, forms of euthanasia. These could occur, for example, when, in order to increase the availability of organs for transplants, organs are removed without respecting objective and adequate criteria which verify the death of the donor. 16. Another present-day phenomenon, frequently used to justify threats and attacks against life, is the demographic question. This question arises in different ways in different parts of the world. In the rich and developed countries, there is a disturbing decline or collapse of the birth rate. The poorer countries, on the other hand, generally have a high rate of population growth, difficult to sustain in the context of low economic and social development, and especially where there is extreme underdevelopment. In the face of overpopulation in the poorer countries, instead of forms of global intervention at the international level, serious family and social policies, programs of cultural development, and of fair production and distribution of resources, anti-birth policies continue to be enacted. Contraception, sterilization, and abortion are certainly part of the reason why in some cases there is a sharp decline in the birth rate. It is not difficult to be tempted to use the same methods and attacks against life also where there is a situation of demographic explosion. The Pharaoh of old, haunted by the presence and increase of the children of Israel, submitted them to every kind of oppression, and ordered that every male child born of the Hebrew women was to be killed. Cf. Exodus 1:7-22. Today not a few of the powerful of the earth act in the same way. They too are haunted by the current demographic growth, and fear that the most prolific and poorest peoples represent a threat for the well-being and peace of their own countries. Consequently, rather than wishing to face and solve these serious problems with respect for the dignity of individuals and families, and for every person's inviolable right to life, they prefer to promote and impose by whatever means a massive program of birth control. Even the economic help which they would be ready to give is unjustly made conditional on the acceptance of an anti-birth policy. 17. Humanity today offers us a truly alarming spectacle, if we consider not only how extensively attacks on life are spreading, but also their unheard-of numerical proportion, and the fact that they receive widespread and powerful support from a broad consensus on the part of society, from widespread legal approval, and the involvement of certain sectors of healthcare personnel. As I emphatically stated at Denver, on the occasion of the 8th World Youth Day, with time the threats against life have not grown weaker. They are taking on vast proportions. They are not only threats coming from the outside, from the forces of nature, or the Cains who kill the Abels, no, they are scientifically and systematically programmed threats. The 20th century will have been an era of massive attacks on life, an endless series of wars, and a continual taking of innocent human life. False prophets and false teachers have had the greatest success. 15 Aside from intentions, which can be varied, and perhaps can seem convincing at times, especially if presented in the name of solidarity, we are in fact faced by an objective conspiracy against life, involving even international institutions engaged in encouraging and carrying out actual campaigns to make contraception, sterilization, and abortion widely available. Nor can it be denied that the mass media are often implicated in this conspiracy by lending credit to that culture which presents recourse to contraception, sterilization, abortion, and even euthanasia as a mark of progress and a victory of freedom, while depicting as enemies of freedom and progress those positions which are unreservedly pro-life. Am I my brother's keeper? Genesis 4:9, a perverse idea of freedom. 18. The panorama described needs to be understood not only in terms of the phenomena of death which characterize it, but also in the variety of causes which determine it. The Lord's question, "What have you done?" Genesis 4:10, seems almost like an invitation addressed to Cain to go beyond the material dimension of his murderous gesture in order to recognize in it all the gravity of the motives which occasioned it and the consequences which result from it. Decisions that go against life sometimes arise from difficult or even tragic situations of profound suffering, loneliness, a total lack of economic prospects, depression, and anxiety about the future. Such circumstances can mitigate even to a notable degree subjective responsibility and the consequent culpability of those who make these choices which in themselves are evil, but today the problem goes far beyond the necessary recognition of these personal situations. It is a problem which exists at the cultural, social and political level, where it reveals its more sinister and disturbing aspect, in the tendency, ever more widely shared, to interpret the above crimes against life as legitimate expressions of individual freedom, to be acknowledged and protected as actual rights. In this way, and with tragic consequences, a long historical process is reaching a turning point. The process which once led to discovering the idea of human rights, rights inherent in every person, and prior to any constitution and state legislation is today marked by a surprising contradiction, precisely in an age when the inviolable rights of the person are solemnly proclaimed, and the value of life is publicly affirmed, the very right to life is being denied or trampled upon, especially at the more significant moments of existence, the moment of birth, and the moment of death. On the one hand, the various declarations of human rights, and the many initiatives inspired by these declarations show that at the global level there is a growing moral sensitivity, more alert to acknowledging the value and dignity of every individual, as a human being, without any distinction of race, nationality, religion, political opinion, or social class. On the other hand, these noble proclamations are unfortunately contradicted by a tragic repudiation of them in practice. This denial is still more distressing, indeed more scandalous, precisely because it is occurring in a society which makes the affirmation and protection of human rights its primary objective and its boast. How can these repeated affirmations of principle be reconciled with the continual increase and widespread justification of attacks on human life? How can we reconcile these declarations with the refusal to accept those who are weak and needy, or elderly, or those who have just been conceived? These attacks go directly against respect for life, and they represent a direct threat to the entire culture of human rights. It is a threat capable, in the end, of jeopardizing the very meaning of democratic coexistence, rather than societies of people living together. Our cities risk becoming societies of people who are rejected, marginalized, uprooted and oppressed. If we then look at the wider worldwide perspective, how can we fail to think that the very affirmation of the rights of individuals and peoples made in distinguished international assemblies is a merely futile exercise of rhetoric, if we fail to unmask the selfishness of the rich countries which exclude poorer countries from access to development, or make such access dependent on arbitrary prohibitions against procreation, setting up an opposition between development and man himself? Should we not question the very economic models often adopted by states which, also, as a result of international pressures and forms of conditioning, cause and aggravate situations of injustice and violence, in which the life of whole peoples is degraded and trampled upon? 19. What are the roots of this remarkable contradiction? We can find them in an overall assessment of a cultural and moral nature, beginning with the mentality which carries the concept of subjectivity to an extreme and even distorts it, and recognizes, as a subject of rights only the person who enjoys full, or at least incipient autonomy, and who emerges from a state of total dependence on others. But how can we reconcile this approach with the exaltation of man as a being who is not to be used? The theory of human rights is based precisely on the affirmation that the human person, unlike animals and things, cannot be subjected to domination by others. We must also mention the mentality which tends to equate personal dignity with the capacity for verbal and explicit, or at least perceptible, communication. It is clear that on the basis of these presuppositions there is no place in the world for anyone who, like the unborn nor the dying, is a weak element in the social structure, or for anyone who appears completely at the mercy of others and radically dependent on them, and can only communicate through the silent language of a profound sharing of affection. In this case it is force which becomes the criterion for choice and action in interpersonal relations and in social life. But this is the exact opposite of what a state ruled by law, as a community in which the reasons of force are replaced by the force of reason, historically intended to affirm. At another level, the roots of the contradiction between the solemn affirmation of human rights and their tragic denial in practice lies in a notion of freedom which exalts the isolated individual in an absolute way, and gives no place to solidarity, to openness to others and service of them. While it is true that the taking of life not yet born, or in its final stages, is sometimes marked by a mistaken sense of altruism and human compassion, it cannot be denied that such a culture of death, taken as a whole, betrays a completely individualistic concept of freedom, which ends up by becoming the freedom of the strong against the weak who have no choice but to submit. It is precisely in this sense that Cain's answer to the Lord's question, "Where is Abel your brother?" can be interpreted, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Genesis 4:9. Yes, every man is his brother's keeper because God entrusts us to one another. And it is also in view of this entrusting that God gives everyone freedom. A freedom which possesses an inherently relational dimension. This is a great gift of the Creator, placed, as it is, at the service of the person, and of his fulfillment through the gift of self and openness to others. But when freedom is made absolute in an individualistic way, it is emptied of its original content, and its very meaning and dignity are contradicted.